All right, let us pray. Our Father in heaven, thank you for our Texas. Thank you for its prosperity, its liberty, especially for the high degree of freedom of religion that we have here. Thank you for all that was done in the pioneer days to set us up for all of this that we enjoy today. Thank you that we get to gather today and learn more about it. I ask that you'll bless the members of our class who have to be absent today, and that you'll bless us here as we learn together. Thank you for our special guest who gets to be here, and I pray this class will be a blessing to her also. I pray that you will use this class to strengthen the students for their turn as the adults in Texas in their generation, so that they will understand what to do and be able to do it. In the name of Jesus, amen. Esther chapter 3. Esther chapter 3. Know why I'm having you turn to Esther. Did you notice the reference to Esther in your reading, chapter 21? Here's what you read in our textbook in chapter 21. Santa Anna was engaged in Mexico in the consolidation of a despotism. Over a timid and superstitious people, his power had become nearly omnipotent. All but Texas had bowed the neck to the imperious tyrant. To him, she was like Mordecai sitting in the king's gate. So, we're going to read that passage to which he is alluding. So, Esther chapter 3, and we want verses 1 through 5, so that will be one verse for each of you. Angela, would you start us, please?
Yes, sir. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him, and set his seat above all the princes that were with him.
And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence.
Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, Why transgressest thou the king's commandment?
And albeit they spake daily unto him, yet he would not hear them. Therefore they told Haman that he might see how Mordecai's matters would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew.
When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath.
Amen. I went and read some about that in the old commentaries, and there was a very much agreement in everything I read that there must have been something beyond just the reverence that is due to government officials over you. Because a righteous man in good conscience can give the homage due that's to government officials who are over him. There must have been something beyond that Mordecai rightly judged that he could not bow down to. So our author has taken that, which is kind of refreshing to think of our author, Henderson Yochum, an American and of the first half of the 1800s, who moved to Texas 1845, was obviously a person well-versed enough in the Bible to recognize in the Texans' refusal to obey Santa Anna when he was establishing a despotism, to see an equivalent with Mordecai refusing to bow down to Haman. Also, if he wrote that in his book, and it didn't have any explanation, it didn't say, you know, see the Bible, Esther chapter 3, you know, he's assuming that his audience, the residents of Texas and the U.S. in the mid to late 1800s, he's assuming they will catch that reference and know what he's talking about. It's kind of a fun glimpse into Texas and the U.S. from that long ago. All right, now the moment you've all been waiting for and looking forward to. La prueba. The quiz. You're getting at least something taken from your timeline, something from last week's lesson, and something from what you read. Ready? Question number one, what year did the second Texas consultation propose statehood for Texas, sending its request to Mexico City by Stephen F. Austin? What year, second Texas consultation? Question number two, what general was appointed by Santa Anna to command the Mexican military force at Monclova in Coahuila? What general appointed by Santa Anna to command the Mexican military force at Monclova in Coahuila? If you want to produce more of his fun name than just the last name, that's fine, but just General so-and-so will do. Number three, when William Travis wrote to Jim Bowie, July 30th, 1835, did the peace party or the war party seem to him stronger at the time? Now, I've given you that date, but, you know, we didn't reference a bunch of their correspondence, and you got to think of that one. I only referenced just that one letter. Did the peace party or the war party seem to him stronger at the time? In 1835, the next question, number four, in 1835, what pioneer Texan led a force of colonists to attack the Mexican army troops at Anahuac? In 1835, what pioneer Texan led a force of colonists to attack the Mexican army troops at Anahuac? You know, from time to time they had to go attack the Mexican troops at Anahuac, but in 1835, who was it? One more question. In 1835, where were the Mexican army troops under Colonel Ugartaquia stationed? Now, I already asked you about the commander of the military at Monclova in Coahuila, but in 1835, where were the Mexican army troops under Colonel Ugartaquia stationed? And, you know, it's not like we said, well, the troops under Colonel so-and-so were so-and-so. That's really the only army force in Texas that we were discussing. Okay, let's check ourselves. What year, second Texas consultation?
1833.
Uh-huh. What general was commanding the military at Monclova?
General Cos.
General Cos.
Martin Perfecto de Cos.
Yeah. Martin, thank you. Martin Perfecto de Cos. And I watched a Hollywood movie in which that name was being pronounced Cos or something like that. Cos is probably just what my English-speaking tongue is doing to that Spanish name. Okay, letter from Travis to Bowie, 1835, in July. Peace party or war party?
Peace party.
The peace party seemed to him stronger at the time. All right, 1835. Who went and attacked Anahuac?
Travis.
Yes, Colonel William B. Travis. What's the B for? Did one of you look that up?
I looked it up, but I can't remember.
Bellinger.
Something.
That was it, wasn't it?
Yes.
Or was that somebody else?
No, that was Travis.
Bellinger.
How did he become colonel?
Who made him colonel? I don't know. You write a 500-page report on that for next week.
They probably...
Okay, 1830. What was it that, my dear?
Well, I seen probably just when they were organizing the militia, they appointed him.
He might have been elected that. So, Colonel Domingo de Ugartaquia, where was he stationed with his Mexican army troops?
Bihar.
San Antonio, or Bihar, because they're the same place. San Antonio de Bihar.
It's not Dexter.
Yeah, even a real un-Spanish speaking person like me doesn't say Bexar. San Antonio de Bihar, and I've read and heard a lot of references from the colonial period to it just as Bihar. We just call it San Antonio. It's San Antonio de Bihar, so either one of those place names is the same. For next time, the next chapter in your Henderson Yochum book, chapter 22, and in my opinion, it's getting more and more interesting. And study your class notes from today's lesson, and study your official timeline. Speaking of your official timeline, Miss Fennec, can you say the whole timeline from memory? All right, let's hear it.
1528, Devoto lands at Galveston Island. 1541, Coronado enters Texas Panhandle from the west. 1542, Soto Expedition enters Texas from the northeast. 1685, LaSalle lands at Matagorda Bay. 1718, San Antonio Mission, Presidio, and Villa are established. 1803, Louisiana Purchase is made. 1819, eastern border of Texas established at Sabine River. 1821, Moses Austin receives a grant to form a colony in Texas. 1824, Mexican federal constitution is passed. 1825, Baptist minister Joseph Bates begins preaching in Texas. 1827, Coahuila y Tejas state constitution is passed. 1829, Lydia Alcorn makes the first known public profession of faith in Christ. 1830, Bustamante takes power and pursues a narrow policy towards Texas. 1832, first Texan consultation meets at San Felipe. 1832, Santa Anna restores constitutionally elected President Pedraza. 1833, Santa Anna becomes president of Mexico under the 1824 Constitution. 1833, Second Texan Consultation proposes statehood for Texas and sends Austin as its delegate to Mexico City. 1834, Stephen F. Austin is arrested and imprisoned in Mexico City.
Yay! Congratulations! That was super good and exactly right.
Yay.
Not a word or letter wrong. And that was very, I know you didn't get to that point without working on it a lot. Congratulations. Okay. In that case, each one of you is going to have to do the same the next 3 weeks. Now that somebody has shown you how it can be done and what the standard is, but who it's going to be each of the next 3 weeks, I will not reveal until the moment comes. So you have to work on it and be ready. Here are two new items for your official timeline. 1835, Stephen F. Austin returns to Texas in September. You know, I've only been given the year on these, but now it's starting to be, you know, what day of the month it happened is important. So I'm going to start adding a month to some of these. Stephen F. Austin returns to Texas in September. Also 1835, war between Texas and Mexico begins with the Battle of Gonzales, October 2nd. So, to get some things you've already learned fresh in your mind, backtrack a little bit. May 1834, the year that Stephen F. Austin was imprisoned in Mexico City. Santa Anna made a pronunciamento, remember? A pronunciamento and plan at Cuernavaca. Those laws that had just been passed by the Cortes and signed by Vice President Farias, all about weakening the hold of the church on the society and weakening the hold of the military and the society, to be declared void. The Cortes that passed such laws dismissed and another convened with the power to form a new constitution. But Santa Anna was not going to be dismissed and a new president chosen. Instead, Santa Anna should be sustained and in charge of carrying the new plan into execution. Okay, so that was big trouble. May 1834, the plan of Cuernavaca. All during that year, the various states in the United States of Mexico were submitting to Santa Anna's new plan, except two state governments, Zacatecas and... Right. So in April and May of the next year, 1 year later, 1835, Santa Anna took part of the army and headed for Zacatecas and defeated that governor's army in a one-day battle and so eliminated the opposition from Zacatecas. General Cos took another part of the army and headed for Monclova and broke up the state government, our state government of Coahuila y Texas. So after that, well, nobody was against the new plan anymore. Okay. So by the month of August 1835, these are the words of our author, by the month of August it was clearly understood that the federal constitution was to be destroyed. So those are things that I've already said to you in the last class. So on to take up where we left off. We had made it to August of 1835, last class. And in August, you know, there were meetings starting to be held all over Texas. There was an important meeting held at Columbia in August. The main importance of it was that a letter was sent from that meeting at Columbia to every town, to every municipality in Texas. and it called for an election to be held October 5th for a general consultation October 15th. Okay, so nobody now was officially the government of Texas. I mean, the elected government had been dispersed. Santa Anna was trying to rule, but there was no true government of Texas. So the various towns were trying to figure out what to do, and that town sent a letter saying, let's have an election and a general consultation to be held in October. The election and the consultation to be held in October 1835. And they resolved that that list of people that General Santa Anna wanted arrested were not going to be surrendered to the government forces. Those two things then became very important in the events that followed in the next few months. So that was in August at Columbia that that letter was sent and that resolution was passed. So let's take our brains forward into September of 1835. And here's a little quote from our author. In the beginning of September, very few doubted that war was inevitable. So that was the state of things beginning of September. You know, which was not necessarily the state of things as recently as just a month or so before. When Travis was writing to Bowie, the war party is in the majority around here, and I think we need to just, be calm and see what happens, and I'm not sure what to do. Remember that? But by the beginning of September, enough had changed that very few doubted that war was inevitable. Santa Anna appointed a governor for our state, Coahuila Teos. Now, you might take down his name, but I don't know that he ended up, being a person of great importance in this history. Don Rafael Musquiz, M-U-S-Q-U-I-Z. Don Rafael Musquiz. But the important point is that how he became governor of our state, he was appointed by Santa Anna, which, of course, in a federal republic...
doesn't happen.
Right. The president doesn't appoint the governor of your state. So that's indicative of how things were going. On September 3rd, largely in response to the resolution from the meeting at Columbia, where they resolved we are not going to be turning over Travis and Zavala and the other men to the government authorities, the government authorities renewed that proscribed persons list, informing the residents of Texas that the army would march into Texas, arrest those on the list, and remove intruders. So that was officially published September 3rd. Well, you can imagine how that is sounding to the Texas colonists. Well, so they're going to arrest our leading men, and whoever they consider intruders will be removed. Okay, that could include just about everybody. I would like to know what day in September Stephen F. Austin made it back to Texas, but the text that I read only said in early September, and he was present at a reception in his honor September 8th. So sometime that first week of September, Stephen F. Austin finally made it back to Texas. There was a reception, a dinner for him, September 8th, and he gave a speech, and he recommended a general consultation. As I was just saying a moment ago, less than a month before that, the people of Colombia had called for a statewide, you know, not statewide, because our state was technically Coahuilateas, but an all of Texas general consultation. They had already proposed a date for the election and for the consultation, and Stephen F. Austin recommended that general consultation. So that then our author says that almost everybody in Texas then agreed on that general consultation. Before that, there was still disagreement about whether that was a good move or not. Once Austin recommended it, September 8th, word got out, and almost everybody then was in favor of the general consultation. You've already heard that the various towns were forming committees of correspondence and committees of safety. Remember the name of the capital of Austin's colony?
San Felipe,
which I suppose means St. Philip. As soon as Austin got back, he was made the chairman of the Committee of Safety at San Felipe. And he and that committee were informed that General Koss, with a military force, was not staying at Monclova, but he was on his way to Texas. And that Committee of Safety, based on that intelligence that General Koss was finally going to actually come with the military, sent out a warning to the other towns, warning that, quote, war was their only recourse, and advising that voluntary militia companies be formed immediately in every town. And sure enough, in mid-September, General Koss landed at Matagorda. That's fun to hear Matagorda mentioned, because that was part of the very old history of Texas, right? Who was it who accidentally landed at Matagorda? Right.
Did he land at Matagorda?
What I read said the middle of September. So much is happening so fast now that we're not talking what happened what year, but what happened what part of what month. 1835, middle of September, General Koss, with 500 men at least, had landed at Matagorda and was headed for San Antonio de Bejar to join up with what colonel was already there with a force? Okay. And so you see, that's in Texas. That's at the main oldest city of Texas, right? Now we get to talk about one of my very favorite things, the Battle of Gonzales. We are now here near the end of September, and we'll cross over into the first few days of October. The Battle of Gonzales. Gonzales was one of the towns in colonial Texas. It's east of present-day San Antonio. Well, you know, San Antonio, where it was then also. It's east of San Antonio. In today's terms, of course, driving in a car on the highway, it's real close to San Antonio. Back then, it wasn't, you know, all that close. Gonzales was one of those colonial towns, and Colonel Ugartaquia had ordered them to return to the army one cannon. At Gonzales, the men had one brass 6-pounder cannon. In 1831, the army had given the people of Gonzales that cannon to defend against raids by the Indians. Now, a 6-pounder brass cannon is nothing that we deal with in normal life, so I want to describe it a little bit to you. It doesn't mean that the cannon weighs 6 pounds. It means that it shoots a 6-pound projectile. If loaded with a solid shot, a solid ball, it's a ball 200 times heavier than a typical ball that the men would have fired out of their rifles. Okay? A 50 caliber rifle ball, it would take 200 of those to weigh the same as a 6-pounder ball. Or, of course, many times they were loaded with grape shot, which is where they put in a whole bunch of small projectiles to where it's like a big shotgun. But how big of a shotgun? Firing grape shot, it would be equivalent to firing 100 shotguns at the same time. 12-gauge shotgun, like we have at our house, and Mr. Van Eck has, that I saw him shoot, like having 100 of those all firing at the same time. Okay? So you have a weapon here that is approximately the equivalent of 100 men firing their weapons all at the same time. So that's a big deal, right? It's a relatively common kind of weapon of that period. It's a small cannon, not a big heavy one, but still a very substantial weapon in those times, in those conditions. Now, what?
How many people would it take to use that effectively?
I don't know. It would have been mounted on a small frame, small wheeled frame, could be moved on a mule. It would take a crew of a few people to work it, 4 or something like that. Now, you know that I find it important to talk to you about the militia whenever it comes up. Think about this for the ramifications of arming the militia. The Mexican army, the official government army of the time in 1831, considered it appropriate for the militia of a small town to have a cannon. The army gave them one. You know, they didn't steal it or anything. The official government army gave the militia of the town a cannon. It was a small cannon, but it was a cannon, okay? And the Texas settlers, our forebears from nearly 200 years ago, they considered it appropriate for a town militia to have a cannon.
So this was the town of Gonzales?
Gonzales, mm-hmm. Yeah. The men of the town, it was a much smaller town than Bonham is, they considered it appropriate for the town militia to have a cannon. And then they considered it unacceptable. Oh, we're not to that part yet. Let me leave that off. Now, you know that these people are people who are very familiar with the United States of America Constitution and our Second Amendment that says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Okay? And at least in, you know, what seems to be evident from this incident, that the Mexican army gave the militia a cannon, and the militia accepted the cannon and had it and used it, they apparently consider the arms that the people have the right to keep and bear to include a cannon. Okay. So Colonel Ugartacia sent a message to the people of Gonzales saying that they needed to return the cannon. Now remember where Colonel Ugartacia was stationed at that time? San Antonio de Bihar, or Bihar. Well, interestingly, the people of Gonzales happened to know that at Bihar, Colonel Ugartatia had lots of cannon already, including several that he didn't have emplaced anywhere because they couldn't get them all mounted. There were some cannon just sitting in the dirt because they didn't have any place to put them. So they answered Colonel Ugartatia, "No, we're not going to return the cannon. It's obvious you're only saying this to try to disarm us, because you don't need the cannon back. You have so many you can't even use all the ones you have." Isn't that interesting? Colonel Ugartakia, so remember this is September, last part of September, 1835. He sent a force of 100 mounted troops under a Captain Castanado to retrieve the cannon from Gonzales, Captain Castanado, and 100, I read one place that they were cavalry, one place that they were dragoons, that's just kind of fun military terminology, not of much importance for this purpose, 100 to retrieve the cannon with orders to do so peacefully. That's a very good question. And I suppose the answer is, if a military force can overawe its enemy, it might be able to accomplish its objectives only by threat of force without the actual use of it. September 29th, 1835, this mounted force under Captain Castanado arrived across the Guadalupe River from Gonzales to find that all the boats had been moved over to the other side.
Imagine that.
September 29th. And that's an old trick. I'm sure it's a very old trick. I have read that in the campaigns of General Washington, when the British were trying to run down General Washington's force in the very bad days of the American War for Independence. One of the things they would do was cross a river and take all the boats over. And so Captain Castanado's force of 100 mounted troops was stymied there on the opposite bank of the river from the town. They requested the cannon, and the Texans in Gonzales started sending back answers that were all stalling. You know, they said, "We can't answer because the mayor is not here. You got to wait till the mayor gets back." And then when the mayor gets back, they said, "Well, we can't tell. We're not sure until the whatever." They were giving a series of answers in which they were stalling for time while people were sending out word that they needed help. And more armed Texas settlers were arriving. There were only, if I recall correctly, fewer than 20 men at Gonzales at the time that the Mexicans arrived, but word went out and people assembled.
They took the boats, so they weren't actually quite there.
Good point, yes. Right. By the next day, September 30th, the Texans numbered, the armed Texas men numbered more than 100, approximately equaling the Mexican troops. And the troops attempted to cross, but found the Texians all set to oppose them and did not actually try to force a crossing. Okay. Battle of Gonzales has not actually been a battle yet. And now the first day of October. October 1st, 1835, by that time the Texans numbered 186 armed men. They elected a Colonel John H. Moore, M-O-O-R-E. And at 7 p.m., the force of Texans crossed the Guadalupe River, having the boats. Having the boats, they could cross the river. And at least 50 of the men had horses. There were at least 50 mounted in this force. And they brought the cannon with them.
But do you know how they got across the river with their horses?
No. October 2nd. And here's why the Battle of Gonzales gets the date October 2nd. The Mexicans took a position on a hill, which is smart, good. Captain Castanado was under orders to seize the cannon peacefully. He was not under orders to engage in a battle, kill everybody, or anything like that. And the Texans were in a cornfield at a distance of 350 yards, three football fields if you include the end zone. And there was a parley.
What?
A parley. P-A-R-L-E-Y, I think. Parley, P-A-R-L-E-Z, is to speak in French.
Mm-hmm.
You know the word parliament? A parliament is where they talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. I assume that parley must be a Latin root. Anybody ever learn that in Latin?
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be a Latin root. And a parley is when someone usually comes forward with flying a white flag, and then representatives from each side come and talk. There was
who sent that out?
Well, now, I forget. I read which side started the parley, but I don't know.
I think it'd be nice.
Don't know. Captain Castanado asked the Texians why they were fighting over this. And Colonel Moore, John H. Moore, replied that the cannon, of course here this is what I've learned from our textbook. Moore replied that the cannon, which the Mexicans were attempting to take, had been placed at Gonzales for the defense of the Constitution and the constitutional authorities. Now, we know about that, right? What year was the federal constitution passed?
1824.
An awful, terrible constitution setting up a despotism? No. A very liberal constitution setting up a republican form of government just like we have. And the state constitution passed what year?
1827.
Uh-huh. And this cannon given to the militia of Gonzales by the Mexican authorities in the year 1831. It was given to them by the duly elected constitutional authorities. Mm-hmm. For the defense of the Constitution and the constitutional authorities, and that no other authority would be obeyed. Now, this order is coming from Captain Castanado, who has got this order from Colonel Ugartacia, who's got his orders from General Cos, who's got his orders from Santa Anna, who was the officially constitutionally elected presidente, until he came up with the new plan and made himself perpetually el presidente, who can now, by military, disperse state governments and all of that. He is not the constitutional authority. And so Colonel Moore says, this was placed here by the constitutional authorities. It will not be removed by any other kind of authority. Now, I guess forevermore, Texas will be subject to accusations that basically people of the United States of America came and took Texas away from Mexico. And that is not so. And part of the purpose of our author in writing as he wrote, and part of the purpose of me teaching this class, is to help today's Texians understand it was not that the people of the U.S. said, let's go get that part of Mexico and take it for ourselves. I mean, some of them might have said that, sure. But what actually happened on the battlefields in colonial Texas was that an unconstitutional despot and those serving under him by his orders, in subversion of the actual constitution of the country and of the state, and in subversion of the very principles of constitutional government, made actual military moves in defiance of the people's rights and of those constitutions. Now, you have probably seen the come and take it flag. There is a flag that gets reproduced on t-shirts and everything, and posters. It's a plain white field and one black star. Everything's just black on white, just simple. One star, a lone star, and then a simple drawing of the old-fashioned cannon, and underneath the words, come and take it. And that flag was definitely present on the battlefields of this conflict between the Texas settlers and Santa Anna's armies. There is apparently no actual historical proof that it was quickly made up and present at this battle. A lot of people say it was at this battle, and there's a lot of drawings of the men of Gonzales with their cannon facing the Mexican troops, and they're flying this flag. So a couple of things that I read about that. One was that the original form of the flag did not have a lone star, but said, come and take it, above and below the cannon. And another thing I read, the person was saying, no doubt this flag was present soon after this battle, in the other battles, but that it was actually present on October 2nd cannot definitively be proven.
It seems a little less likely.
So it clearly was a hastily constructed flag, because it's just a plain white field with all black, simple hand-drawn and handwritten things. So it's possible that it could have been present, but apparently that is something that we have to just not be sure of. It was present soon after, possibly present that day, October 2nd. So they had this parley. It did not produce a conciliation. So then, after the parley, the parties having returned to their armies, the Texans fired the cannon and then charged. And the Mexicans did not stay and fight, but left the field. Now, I read that, as I already mentioned to you, Captain Castanado was not under orders to have a battle, to kill the Texians or anything. He was under orders to go there and peacefully retrieve the cannon. And so I don't think it's simply that when the Texans fired their cannon and came charging, the Mexicans all screamed and ran away like sissies. I don't think that's the idea. But the Mexican force fled the field, leaving the Texans victorious in the field of battle in possession of the cannon. no Texans were killed in the engagement, and some small number of Mexicans were killed. I don't mean to minimize that fact by saying it was a few, but it was only a small number. Now I'll read you a quote from our author about this. The affair at Gonzales was the first overt, do you know the words covert and overt? Covert, hidden, unknown, overt, open, known. There might be a, what?
Like cover.
Right. And there is an old word in the old Bibles, like the King James and I think the Geneva Bible, that I think it says that behemoth hides in the covert, or is in the covert or something. But there's the old word covert, which is a noun, or covert, which is an adjective. I've heard it used in about secret agents, covert operations. Matter of fact, I think that's in current usage. I think when the army does something where they sneak in behind enemy lines and do something, it's a covert operation. Overt means not hidden, not secret. The affair at Gonzales was the first overt act on the part of their oppressors. They, the Texians, met and repelled it, as did the people at Lexington and Concord. And we talked about this some last time, right? At Lexington and Concord, General Gage sent out the Marines to go and do a certain thing. Remember what it was? That's right. Seize the ammo, or as they would have called it, the magazine. To seize the magazine at the town of
Concord.
And the reason it's the Battle of Lexington and Concord is that you go through Lexington to get to Concord, and some of the Minutemen opposed them at Lexington. They were off to seize the magazine, the gunpowder and bullets and whatever, I think gunpowder mainly, at Concord. So our author is seeing the correspondence between those two things. They met and repelled it, as did the people at Lexington and Concord. Now, the Battle of Lexington and Concord was much more of a battle. A number of people were killed on each side. The forces involved were much larger. The British Marines, if I recall correctly, were 700 in number. The number of colonists who eventually came and participated was above 1,000, I believe. And this was a battle of 100 versus 200, and only a very few were killed and only on one side. It was much less of a battle, but in the eyes of our author, apparently essentially the same thing. A government not in keeping with its right exercise of constitutional powers, but in an act of despotism, moves to seize the militia's arms. The militia opposes them, and in both cases, successfully.
It's interesting how a lot of the battles and different things, that the number which are so small compared to the two other worlds, it's just kind of like they don't
right.
Seven people in the state. Just, as a percentage,
yep.
Far less. So.
That's right. And in both of those cases, Lexington, Concord, and Gonzales, it's largely because it's a colonial setting. You know, there's a wilderness and there's colonists, and so then it's a small numbers. And last week, I believe Mrs. Van Eck was pointing out that a lot of times conflict between the people and their corrupt government only really becomes civil war or revolution or war for independence when the government forces start killing people. You know, when they're taxing you too much and what have you, yeah, people will oppose with words, but it's when they really start killing people that it ends up open conflict. And I said, yes, I agree. And especially when the killing is by actual military invasion. Okay, the army is actually walking through our towns right now. Or, you know, in the case of King Charles, the army actually came to Parliament to arrest some of the members of Parliament, and here you see that it's our author brings out an aspect of it that neither Mr. and Mrs. Van Eck nor I mentioned last week. He says the army was coming to seize the people's arms. And that's when it switched from real tense conflict and lots of writing of letters and angry speeches to, okay, now it's war between armies. When the corrupt government officials actually send the army to take your guns, that's when you know, okay, now we form companies and we make an army and oppose them. And I had forgotten about that. I really had forgotten about that because I gave this class 7 years ago, and I have right in my notes from 7 years ago, in both the American and the Texas Wars for Independence, the thing that really started the war was the central government's military marching to seize the people's arms. You might put that away in your conscience for your life as Texans, or you know, or wherever you end up living, because human rights are the same no matter where you live. You might put that away in your conscience. How do you know when writing letters to your congressman, when giving speeches, when trying to convince your friends, when posting articles on the internet, you know, how do you know when now it's time for the people to, you know, get their rifles out of the closet and out of the gun safe and go form up into units and actually start opposing? You know, one of the historical examples that you can, multiple historical examples, when the government actually sends their armed force to seize your weapons. That's one of the times that you can be sure it's time for that. Okay, friends. Well, that's all for... Oh, you know what? No. We've got a couple minutes, and there's something else. I've heard you all listening to the old country and western ballad about the Alamo. And there's a line that the singer sings. To fight for the right to be free. Right? People from Texas and from old Tennessee, something about coming to the Alamo to fight for the right to be free. Okay. So, when people are fighting for their rights, that's a shorthand way of saying something. It's not technically accurate. How do you get your inalienable rights? How does a person get inalienable rights?
Just have them.
Yes. God makes him. He is at some moment conceived in his mother's womb, and at that moment has his inalienable rights. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, etc. Nobody ever has to fight to get or keep his inalienable right, his inalienable rights. Really what he has to fight, or in other ways struggle to keep, is liberty. The freedom to exercise and enjoy those rights. By long usage, it's well established to talk about fighting for your rights or to fat for your rats. Apparently, the Yankees found it very funny when they would encounter Southerners during the war between the states who would talk about that they came to fat for their rats. It sounded to the Yankees like, you know, to fat for your rats, you know. But anyway, to fat for the rats. That's shorthand to fight for your rights. But you're not really fighting for your rights. You have them. You are fighting for the liberty or freedom in which to exercise and enjoy those rights. Somebody can't come and take away your rights, although we talk like that. He comes and infringes your rights. He comes and takes away your liberty or freedom in which to enjoy your rights. It's an important point to understand. That people just have their rights. They're inalienable. They cannot be made alien from you. here's me and here's my rights and we're together. Nothing can be done by man to take me away from my rights, take my rights away from me. What man can do, and so often tries to do, is take away my liberty, infringe my rights to where I don't have the liberty to enjoy them. Okay, friends.